That's a good question. I think for me, I have to be active in all aspects of chess. At the same time, I try to play whenever I can. My first priority is arbitering, of course, but also I'm organizing some tournament here in England, and also I am a chess teacher at the same time. So I think this is something amazing about chess, which allows us to work in different areas.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the November edition of our FIDE podcast of the Year Women in Chess. In this podcast, we introduce you to some amazing and inspiring women in the world of chess, including players, authors, coaches, journalists, chess streamers, and arbiters. The podcast is a collaboration of the Chess Sports Association, the FIDE Women's Commission, and the German podcast Schachgeflüster. Today's guest is a very versatile person that brings so many positive facets and aspects into the chess world. She's a strong player herself and carries the WFM title. Additionally, she's an international arbiter for FIDE and worked as an arbiter on some of the biggest and most important tournaments, such as the Women's World Chess Championship. She's also a female role model, fighting for women's rights in her country of origin, Iran. I'm absolutely pleasured and honored to welcome Shori Bayat as our guest today. Welcome, Shori.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to me to be here. Thank you.
Okay, so let's get started with our first question straight away. As our guests from the podcast come from all over the world, it has become a tradition over the past year to ask where they're from and to tell us a little bit about their country and what the chess culture is like there.
Well, I'm originally from Iran, but right now I'm a refugee in the United Kingdom. I have experience of both representing Iran and England national teams. I think both countries have chess culture. In Iran, we believe that we invented chess as a part of Persian Empire many, many ages ago. But I know that it's a bit debatable because also India claims that at the same time. But we know that chess is very popular there. Also, I think in the UK, chess is growing a lot. In England now, we have chess in many clubs, many national tournaments, and it's growing and growing. Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you so much for that introduction. We'll touch up on Iran and England a little bit later, but let's start a little bit with, I guess, where it all started for you, because you started playing chess as a child and were quite talented straight away and won numerous national tournaments already in your youth, such as the Girls Under 12 Championship in Iran, but then also later on the Iran Women's Chess Festival, some Blitz and Rapid Championships. What would you say from all the tournaments you played, is there a most memorable one to you, or what would you consider your biggest success?
That's a difficult one to choose because I played in many different levels in Iran. But I'm kind of proud that I was champion in Iranian Women's Chess Festival and also a junior champion in females level in Iran. And also I won medal in all age groups from under 12 to under 20 every year. So these are part of things that I'm proud of. And also I'm quite happy that I represented both Iran and England national chess teams.
Yeah, loads of successes to choose from, actually. When you started, so we already just said that there was a lot of national tournaments you did really well in, but you also said that you played for both the Iranian and the English national team. So that means chess enabled you to play a lot of tournaments abroad. And I was wondering what role that played for you and for your chess development, but maybe also for your personal development.
Chess had a big impact in my life because I think it kind of shaped my personality at the same time. Chess provides loads of opportunity for traveling, and we can learn from traveling. That's very important. It broadens our knowledge and horizons. And when we travel to each country, we learn about a new culture. So this is very important and valuable for me. Also, I learned from chess about planning, calculation, judgment, and critical thinking, and of course many, many benefits that that chess has, and it is impossible to mention all of them at the same time. But one of the things that was very critical for me was this critical thinking, because I came from a country, Iran, in which, of course, women were kind of restricted. And as a result of that, chess provided me more opportunity to be able to compare different societies and different countries at the same time.
Yeah, it's a lot of, I guess, like traveling in general educates, and a lot of the skills we learn in chess can be transferred to wider life. Okay, what I'd like to focus on next, because I know you're a great chess player, but I think what you're even more known for is that besides playing chess yourself, you're also one of the top arbiters actually in the chess world. And can you tell us a little bit on how you became interested in being an arbiter and your journey to get there?
Yes, that's quite interesting, because my journey for being arbiter started since I played since I was a kid and I was a player, because in my country Iran, women couldn't play against men and other genders. So basically my father managed to get some permission for me, because I was the only top player in my city, so I was allowed to play against male players at the same time. But when I used to go to their tournament, I was the only female player, and I was quite young, at the age of let's say 10, something like that. And then I didn't have anybody to speak to, because it was a male dominated area. And basically, I was just watching arbiters, how they do pairings with those cards. Those days, we didn't have Swiss Manager. So it was like every week I was there and I was watching arbiters how to work. Eventually, I became interested in being arbiter, but they wouldn't allow me to participate in arbiters course, because it was not allowed until you are at the age of 18 in Iran. And I was just asking to allow me to participate in the course, but they said that if you participate, we know that you can pass the exam, and then we cannot give you certificate for that. So that was how my journey started. But as soon as I became to the age of 18, I participated in those courses. I got my arbiter's degree, and we had three different level of national arbiters in Iran. I kind of mixed that with experience of arbiting, and also I was playing at the same time. But when I participated later in a FIDE arbiter seminar, then I realized that I just want to continue as an arbiter. So I started slowly to be retired from playing and replace it with arbiting.
Okay, for our listeners that might be a bit confused why arbiters are needed in chess, as the rules are pretty clear, could you maybe explain what exactly the roles are that arbiters play in a tournament? So what is the scope of the projects they have? And maybe like give one or two examples of when like an arbiter was necessary in these tournaments for like claiming a dispute?
Yes, sure. The arbiter's role in chess is divided in three areas: before the tournament, during the tournament, and after the tournament. Before the tournament, it's basically regarding pairing, inspection of the playing hall to make sure that we provide a proper environment for players. During the tournament, we make sure that laws of chess are being followed, and also anti-cheating matters, and we make sure that everybody are playing in a fair environment. And then after the tournament, we need to publish the standing, and of course to report tournaments for rating and this sort of matters.
Very interesting. And I assume, especially at the moment where we have so many online cheating, chess things happening, that the role of the arbiter becomes very much visible. Because usually if all goes well, I guess, as arbiters, you're always in the background, right?
Yes, that's true. Actually, the best orbiters, we say that the orbiters which are kind of invisible, but they are not invisible at the same time, because they don't want to go and show off. They don't want to distract players by getting so close to their boards. But at the same time, they are supervising all and each players in the playing hall. Especially these days that we have many chess softwares, the role of arbiters regarding fair play matters is very important. They must supervise players all the time and to make sure that the playing area and the playing situation is totally safe.
Mm-hmm. And what is it that you particularly like about arbitering? Like, for example, if you would have to convince someone, or like especially to, like, for example, try to get more women into chess, why would you say should people go into arbitering? What is it that you really enjoy about it?
I think I have always loved the rules and regulations, so I think this is something that I'm good at. It I can talk and debate for even one sentence in the rules for hours and days and weeks. So this is something very common among arbiters. I think this is my interest to rules, and at the same time I love chess. I enjoy watching games and learning from them. So, and also I love our chess environment. So it is a opportunity to be in different chess tournaments, to travel, and also to enjoy social aspects of chess.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, like, you're an incredibly talented arbiter without doubt, and you were an arbiter at pretty much most of the big events, I would say, at like Olympiads, the Women's World Championship, the London Chess Classic, Gibraltar. Is there a specific tournament that you haven't been to that you would really like to go, or do you still have, like, once you've been to all these big tournaments, what are your ambitions as an arbiter from here onwards?
I think I'm quite happy with the events that I'm working on it. My ambition is just to keep myself always up to date and to study and to provide some educational documents for arbiters. As you know, since 4 years ago, I was working in the FIDE Arbiters Commission as well. So I'm in charge of FIDE Arbiters Manual. This is something that made me so happy, because I could develop the book a lot. I know not only me, but many other arbiters also contributed to this book. But I think this is something that for me is the next step, to educate other arbiters, to help the other arbiters to develop to their development, and increasing the number of female arbiters. Yeah.
And the FIDE Arbiters Commission, so what exactly does this commission do? So you update the rules, and then you also organize some coaching sessions for new arbiters?
Actually, we don't update the rules, but we comment on that. We give guidelines to arbiters about how to understand each article, what is the behind of each article, and we give them different examples how to behave in different situations, and then we allow them mm-hmm. to compare those things together to be able to act in even situations that they are not familiar with. We also organize different FIDE Arbiter seminars around the world. During the pandemic time, we started to go online as well. So we organized many courses for people who wanted to be online arbiters and also to work in hybrid tournaments at the same time. We worked in educating our lecturers, because we have many FIDE lecturers at the same time. So we organize some sessions for them to have some standardized exams and also materials that they can use. Also in FIDE Arbiters Commission, we provided a platform that is accessible for all arbiters. They can to accessible for all lecturers and some also many arbiters, that they can get access to sample questions of exams at the same time.
Okay, so loads of different things actually that are happening in the commission there. Maybe I have one question to follow up, because one of the things, I mean, arbiters, like I guess everything in chess, is there's not so many females. How do you think the number of female arbiters can be increased?
I think this is something that we need to work from national levels as well, because we need federations also to support the arbiters. FIDE is one part, and then the national federations to support the arbiters, and also especially continental federations as well. Because, for example, I can give you an example of Asia based on my personal experiences. I was the first category A female arbiter in Asia, and then I felt that Asia is a male-dominated continent for arbiters because there was not enough opportunity for female arbiters. And I got the title because of working in world events, but at the same time, we couldn't get opportunity to work in continental events. At the same time, now this year I became the best European arbiters from FIDE in female section. But I see that I'm receiving many, many invitations from European Chess Federation, and there are loads of opportunities to work for continental tournaments here. So in order to work and increase the number of female arbiters, I think we need to work in a way to increase and help arbiters in national levels and continental levels as
Yeah, and just offer possibilities for them to gain experience and like motivate them to go in. Yeah, I think these are really good points. One match I want to talk to you, because it was one of the big matches you served as an arbiter as, but I mean it was also personally a very, very life-changing event for you, is in 2020, where you served as the chief arbiter of the Women's World Championship match. And during the tournament, a photograph appeared, which in Iran was interpreted as you not wearing a hijab and created a big controversy. Do you want to tell us about the tournament and what exactly happened there?
Yes, that was a very important tournament for me. I was so happy that I got appointed to that tournament because that was the highest tournament in my chess career that I worked in. And then, as you know, many things and drama happened during the tournament, which I was not expecting. The tournament had two legs, one leg in China and the second leg in Russia. When I was in China during the tournament, some of photographs of me was published from an angle that my headscarf was not very visible. And then Iranian media used those photographs to condemn me for not wearing headscarf. Actually, I was wearing it, but in a loose way. But unfortunately, there was no time to explain it to media because they were already condemned me. They asked for public apology. There were loads of pressures from the federation also. They told me to just wear black clothes and cover all your hair and write public apologies. Of course, that was a clear decision that I couldn't do these things because I believe that people should be themselves. They shouldn't follow the things and do actions that they don't actually believe on them. So I decided to not wear a headscarf anymore. I went to the tournament after four rounds in which I had a headscarf out of mandatory hijab, not out of choice. And then I decided not to wear it to stand by Iranian people because Iranian people are people who believe in freedom of choice. This is not our culture. I know that some people misunderstand our culture and they think that hijab is our culture, but it is not. Back then, I think that was a right decision, and if things go back, I still take the same decision to stand for what I believe in. That was the one aspect of the tournament. The other aspect was that because this happened during this World Chess Championship tournament, I used the tournament as a coping mechanism at the same time, because I told to myself, I'm here because of this tournament. I have to do my role and responsibility properly. And also my life is changing and it's affecting all my life, but I have to just concentrate on the tournament. And I think from chess perspective, the tournament was a big success.
Yeah, it must have been, you know, you go to this tournament and you're just so proud to serve as an arbiter there, and then things happen that you're just not prepared for. And it's absolutely, to me, absolutely amazing how you still manage to be such a good arbiter there and just take such strong decisions.
Thank you.
And I think that's very admirable. So after the tournament, you then couldn't return to Iran and you decided to go to the UK. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And I remember that when I was at the airport, I had a ticket, printed ticket of my flight to Tehran. So the office there at the UK airport in London found it and took it for the record of his documents. So yeah, I was very happy to come back to Iran, but unfortunately it didn't happen and I had to find another destination to come. I'm very pleased to be in the UK right now because this is a country which respects to human rights and women rights. And I received many supports from people here and especially my chess family. So I think I'm lucky to be a chess player, to have a chess family.
Yeah, because you really, like in the UK, then you took so many positions straight away and you got involved as a arbiter, and I've seen you, as I said, now also played for the UK national, well, the English national team, because it's not UK that plays, right? So yeah, you really made chess, I guess it was a way to get in contact there with people and settle there as well.
Yes, actually, we always say that we are one family, that's our motto, but I couldn't really understand and feel it until I moved here, because when you understand these things when you are in tough and difficult situations. And when I came here, immediately people who I didn't know them, they offered me to live with them, those chess people. I was very lucky to stay with two chess arbiters, Laura Barnes and Alex McFarlane. I lived with them for some time, and that was quite funny because we had three top arbiters at the same time in one house.
Oh wow! I can see what geeky conversations you had at the dinner table.
Exactly. So every conversation was about chess, and then at some time, three of us were in the same Zoom meeting for FIDE arbiters committee at the same time. So that was quite funny. But also, I was then moved to London, and then another international master, John Cox, offered me to live with him and his family for some time. So they helped me as well. I work for CSC, Chess in the Schools Community, running by Malcolm Payne. And it's something that I'm very happy about it. I think the best job in the world is to work with children and teaching them chess. So I think that's the best thing that happened to me. And also, I'm very lucky to work for English Chess Federation. I'm director of event and board member there. And yes, I also represented England. I played in some tournament here as well. So after such a long gap here, first I played in some online tournaments during the COVID time, and I actually won some tournaments at the same time as well. Then I played in Richmond tournament, and I won the first female prize there as well. And now also I'm a coach in the same place as well. Yeah.
So loads of facets. It's going to be interesting to see where your journey continues, because, I guess being an arbiter and being a player always happens at the same time. So I'm curious what you'll do for the next few months or years, or where you'll put your priority.
That's a good question. I think for me, I have to be active in all aspects of chess. At the same time, I try to play whenever I can. My first priority is arbitering, of course, but also I'm organizing some tournament here in England, and also I am a chess teacher at the same time. So I think this is something amazing about chess, which allows us to work in different areas.
Yeah, and the chess teaching you do in schools with children or adults or everyone?
It's actually chess for primary school children. So chess is a part of school curriculum in England. And I work in different primary schools to teach chess to children. Also, for some time, I went to Cardiff as well. I was covering 4 different primary schools there as well. It's just amazing to teach chess to other people and seeing how they can enjoy and benefit from chess, especially children, you know. That's very important.
Yeah. So you really take all the aspects of chess. That's what I call a real chess life, I guess. Before we move on with some further chess question, I'd like to go back to your, well, the role you play in fighting for women's rights in Iran, because it's a very important topic again at the moment with all the massive protests happening in Iran. And I also saw that your story is picking up in visibility now again, and that you've been interviewed by some of the big newspapers. And actually, I'm German. I also saw that you were a guest in one of the German podcasts. So I just wanted to see how you see your role now that you're in the UK. What do you see your role as in the current situation in the fight for women's rights?
Yes, that's something that happened in my life. And then it kind of turned to my responsibility right now to speak up, because it's important to fight for women's rights and for human rights. We cannot stay quiet about these things. Sometimes it's very difficult for me, because it's also very sad to see what is happening in Iran when you see innocent people are being killed for asking their basic rights for just freedom of choice. And this is something that I think about it every day. I can't stay quiet about it. And I think this is my responsibility to support Iranian people, to be their voice whenever I can. That's why I give interviews to different media, and also these days with Iranian TVs as well. I mean, overseas TVs. But also I'm planning to go to US in November for 2 reasons. First part is to arbitrating some chess tournaments, and the second part is that I will go to Washington, D.C. to speak about the Iranian situation with people in U.S. Department of State to make sure that we support Iranian people.
Oh, wow, that is indeed very big. And I think actually in the U.S., people took note of your actions before, because you were awarded the International Woman of Courage Award in 2020. What is this award exactly? Because I think it's also a US award. And what does it mean to you?
This is something that I am proud of it. But at the same time, I think that I don't deserve it. Because when I see how many courageous ladies and people are in Iran, I feel that this award should belong to them. There could be many people other than me who could be nominated for this award. And I thought that I should accept it, because then it helps to Iranian people to raise their voice around the world, so that people can hear their message of freedom, peace, women love freedom, which is very important for us. That's why I accepted this award, but I also mentioned that I'm just representing Iranian women, and this award belongs to all of them.
Yeah, these are very, very powerful words, and I think it's you know, being in a position like you are, like in the spotlight, or being a famous sports person comes with a lot of perks, but very often also with a lot of responsibility, and it's not always easy to take. So moving on from that, I think, yeah, as I said, it's super inspirational, not just for women in chess, of course, but for everyone to see. But of course, I'm very proud that someone from the chess world is taking such a courageous role. Should we follow up a little bit on the tournaments you mentioned that you'd be arbitering in the US? So what is your agenda for the rest of the year? Which tournaments can we expect to see you?
For now, I'm planning to go to North Carolina for arbitrating some tournaments, master tournaments in Charlotte. So this is quite exciting for me because I know that Charlotte Chess Center is really doing great, and I see people running this organization are really inspiring. So I think this is an honor for me to cooperate with them and work with them. That's my plan for November. But also, as you know, every day in my life is about chess. So from each Monday to Friday, I'm teaching chess to children in primary schools. I also planning to organize an national norm tournament for English players, but open to foreign players as well. It will be in Cambridge in February, so I have to work on this tournament to make it possible.
I'm a bit biased, but I would recommend people, if they are interested in the national, to people to go, because Cambridge is absolutely beautiful. Will this be a open tournament or a women's specific one?
It will be an open tournament, but we also are organizing a round robin female tournament at the same time as a side event tournament. This is something for ladies as well, so they can decide to participate in round robin section or in open section.
Perfect, sounds great. One question that came to my mind when you said that you're going to arbiter a tournament in the US, or I guess any tournament, is do you have a specific preparation when you arbiter a tournament? You know, I guess like players have like their like a increased training schedule or something like this. Is there a particular thing you do to prepare for a tournament, or do you have any kind of rituals before the games or before you go to these tournaments?
Before each tournament, when I want to work in a tournament, I try to review Laws of Chess one more time. I don't know how many times I have read it, but for each tournament, I force myself to read it one more time. And then also, I need to study regulation of that specific tournament, because for each tournament, we have a regulation. And during the tournament, of course, our job is different, but as you asked about preparation, I think these are my preparation to make sure that I'm up to date with all laws and regulations.
Okay, then this is the preparation during the tournament. What can I imagine your day to be like? Because you will probably have to be there before. You're probably the first to come and the last to leave.
Yes, during the tournament, my preparation partly is before the first round, so I need to go to the playing hall to make sure that everything is ready. So I kind of patrol the playing hall, chairs, tables, all equipment, fair play things, everything, light, ventilation, and also we check registered players, their ratings, and then I use some pairing software, so I need to check for each tournament which pairing software we want to use. And then during the tournament, of course, our job is supervising, inputting results, and to make sure that these are correct, and also to supervise fair play matters.
Yeah, and again, because I guess arbitering is very... A lot of us don't know that much about it. How are arbiters for different tournaments are appointed? Are you going, if you see an interesting tournament, do you message the organizers, or do the organizers message you? Like, what is the procedure there?
I think it depends on which level of orbiting you are working. When I was not a famous orbiter, I used to write to organizers, and then I was getting in touch to them to see if they would like me to orbiting in their tournaments or not. But then when you are quite famous, then you receive invitations from organizers. So currently I don't write to organizers, but mostly organizers write to me. So this is exactly depends on where you are standing, and this is a journey for being an orbiter. At some point, you need to get as much as experience as possible, but then later you can select which tournaments to orbiting.
Okay, very interesting. Can I ask you what is your most crazy story you have from orbitering a tournament? Was there ever something that was really bizarre or like out of the ordinary?
I think yes. Maybe this recent World Rapid and Blitz in Poland was quite bizarre because we had some players who tested positive for COVID. So at some point we had to stop the tournament, stop the round to make sure that all players are being tested, to make sure that the environment is safe for everybody. And then, you know, when you stop around, everybody comes and asks what is happening. Then medias come and ask, and then you cannot sometimes quote because you have to wait to get information from other people, organizers and people in charge, especially in FIDE events. This is it has its own procedures. So I think the situation was quite difficult. It was not about technical matters, but this is something that was important for safety of all players. So we delayed the round for several hours to make sure that the players are playing there are not COVID positive.
And that is nothing any arbiter course can ever prepare you for. That is just something you have to decide on the spot. It's in none of the books. So yeah, I can imagine it's quite a difficult decision to take.
Exactly. But part of arbiting is, you know, the ability to manage things as well. So this is very important to be able to act fast and proper decisions.
Yeah. Another thing that I feel put like a complete new and unknown dimension onto arbitering is when actually Corona hit and then so many of the tournaments moved online. Because before most tournaments were in person. How did you feel about that process? And do you actually enjoy the arbitering online as well? Or is that something where you say this is not for you?
Yeah, when these things happened, things started to go online and we had different chess platforms. We were not familiar with the online orbiting at the same time, but we had to experience it and learn it. And then the way that you work in each platform is different from the other one because, you know, the structure of platforms are different from each other. Eventually, we managed to find Zoom and then use it in chess tournaments, and of course there are some other video communication systems as well, but Zoom is quite comfortable for chess tournaments. I can say that I really enjoyed it because I think this is the power of chess, that you can use this game over the board and online at the same time. And I think it kind of made me busy during all the time of pandemic. So I was always working in tournaments. And still now that we passed those process of COVID, still we have this. We have our online tournaments. I was recently orbiting Fischer Random Chess, which was online, and I really quite enjoyed it.
I guess it gives it similarly than for playing. It's just a different atmosphere, shorter time control. So I assume as an arbiter, it's like similar, that it's just like completely different skills. Though I have to say, I imagine it's quite tiring as an arbiter to stay focused all the time on these online tournaments.
I don't think it is tiring because it depends. If you love your job, you are enjoying every second of it. And there are lots of things to do. You are always supervising players, for example. You are supervising their eye contact, how the eyes are moving around. This is something that you have to concentrate on it. And then you have to check, for example, their desktops. They are sharing their desktops, their computer's screen with you. And so you have to go through them to make sure that they don't have any applications open. And because you are working all the time, there's no time to think about other things, you know? And I don't find it boring at all.
Okay. Well, not boring, but I thought it would be tiring because I always feel super exhausted after like 2 hours in front of my screen. But it seems like you're just energetic enough to make it work. I'm also interested because we talk about like online chess and over the board chess. What is your personal opinion about cheating online, and should it kind of have consequences on over the board games, or are these for you two separate things?
I think this is a difficult question to answer. Maybe there are more qualified people in Fair Play Commission to answer it. But I believe that it shouldn't be the same. I don't think if we should consider people who are flagged in online events for over the board events as well, because the question is that what if we made the mistake? Because some platforms disqualify players, but then they cannot say legally that this player was cheating. They say that it was not following the terms and conditions of website, because they see the patterns, they see that the statistical analysis doesn't work properly for this player. I mean, doesn't match properly with the level of games and ratings. But then they cannot say for sure for 100% that this player was cheating online. That's why I think even if one person we are making mistake, we cannot extend it to over the board games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's it's a common opinion, even though I guess it's hotly debated in the chess world. Have you ever, during your time as an arbiter, whether online or over the board, have you ever experienced any cheating cases?
Yes, I have experienced, unfortunately, many cheating cases. We had to disqualify many players in different tournaments. But maybe it's because I also worked in many, many online tournaments since the start of the pandemic. So in national events, in online Olympiads, in different tournaments, we had the experience of players who were not following the a fair play procedure.
And this happens both in adult tournaments and in youth tournaments?
Yes, but from my experience, it was more common in youth tournaments, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that's one of the difficult decisions to take about these cheating things, is especially online. I also experienced this when we organized tournaments in Germany during the time that we experienced cheating, even in very unimportant tournaments where there is no prize money and nothing. But, you know, in the end, there is still kids and teenagers. So it's difficult to find the right way to, in a way, punish them, but most of all, make it educational so that these things don't happen again.
Yes, I think it's very important that we educate our young generation about this fair play and about the consequences of cheating, and to encourage them to play fairly, because I think that also some part of it can be sometimes because of the parents to put loads of pressure on their children to win their games, and then those kids don't want to disappoint their parents. So there are many let's say underlying reasons behind of these things.
And what role in these, hopefully prevention of cheating, so we stop it before it happens, what are the ways forward in your opinion? Should this be something that's like the arbiter's role to educate, or is this something the coaches should do, or the national federations, or is it a combined effort?
I think it should be a combined effort. I also see that some platforms, one of the platforms was asking people before the game to acknowledge that they are playing fairly. That was something nice because before each round, you had to confirm that you are not cheating. This was something nice. And also, I think this is the role of chess coaches to teach to kids that how important the nature of chess and enjoying chess is. And this is the first thing. It's not just about winning or losing. It's about benefiting from different aspects of chess.
Yeah, and I guess in an ideal world, then chess also is there, right? To teach sportsmanship and to teach like any sport, like this fair behavior towards each other and make people learn to win and to lose, even though it's not easy to lose.
Exactly. And I think that this is not just responsibility of one organization. I think this is the responsibility of national federations, coaches, clubs, parents, and FIDE at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I share that opinion, I have to say. Another question I have that I'm interested in is, if you catch people cheating or you take them out of tournaments, have you ever had any negative reaction towards you? Or is that something as an arbiter you sometimes experience if people are unhappy with your decision? Or do people generally accept the arbiter's decision?
I personally never experienced negative behaviors towards me, but I had people who initially didn't admit that they were cheating. So I had to speak to them to mention the reasons that I think they were cheating. And sometimes it's about, you know, kids, and then you get the parents involved, and eventually they learn that this was a mistake and they try to change their behavior. But
I think it's a good way, especially for kids, to get the parents involved, and as I said, make give them another chance, but also make it an educational learning and make sure that it shouldn't happen again.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, out of curiosity, have you ever experienced any cheating in over-the-board tournaments?
No, I haven't ever experienced any cheating in over-the-board tournaments. I have found a cell phone in a toilet. I have cases. Even in Olympiad, we found someone carrying cell phone with him during the games. But they didn't consider those situations as a cheating. For example, the case that we found a phone in a toilet, it was in Thailand chess tournament. And the player at the middle of the game realized that he has a phone and he forgot to give it to the arbiters before the round. And he thought that if I give it to arbiters now, I'm going to be forfeited. So he just wanted to get rid of his phone and he tried to hide it in a toilet. So when we found it, we tried to talk to the player and do some investigations, and we saw that there wasn't any game from that round on the phone, or there wasn't any specific chess application that could be used for cheating.
So your recommendation would also be in a tournament, if there is an honest mistake and you realize, okay, My phone is still in my bag and I thought it isn't, that's like a good point to go to the arbiters and be like, listen, this was a mistake, and there will be a solution probably.
I think sometimes our rules needs to be modified because there are some rules that are too strict. But I also understand the other parts why it's too strict. But in some areas, arbiters should have more freedom to decide in such cases. Right now, the rule says that if it's found that the player is carrying a phone during the game, it has to be forfeited. But, you know, there are some cases, even grandmasters forget to give their phone to the arbiters, and then after 5 moves, they come and say, this is my phone.
I think it's actually one of the interesting parts, right, about the rules, that you always think the rules are so clear and they're written there, but in the end it's like a lot of still a lot of interpretation and how to deal with the roles in certain situations.
Yes, I think a lot of chess should be improved and can be improved a lot. Right now, it's kind of, you know, controversial, and there are many suggestions that can improve the laws and regulations better.
One question, I guess, that always comes to my mind about arbiters is, if you have, for example, a big tournament with kids, you know, that happens quite often. So I'm not an arbiter. I know nothing about arbitering. But when I still taught kids, and then there's always this moment when one person said that the opponent touched a piece and the opponent says, no, I didn't. And I guess in kids' tournaments, there's always, you know, so many boards that there's not, like, in a world championship, one arbiter in one board. So how would you handle a situation like that?
I normally try to listen to both sides. I ask one player and then I ask the other player. And then when I see that the story doesn't match, I ask them to show me exactly how they did it. And then that's, most of the time, it helps me to find out what was the reality. Because when they exactly repeat that action again, then I can see what was happening. But yeah, there are some cases that you cannot figure out as well. But I think in most cases you can.
And what do you do in cases where you can't figure it out? At the end, the decision has to be made, right?
Yeah, I think we need to make the most possible fair decision. I mean, if you are accusing someone to for a touch move and then there is no evidence of that, without evidence and not admitting, then we cannot accept that.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, maybe following up a little bit on you as a, on your personal life a little bit, because I saw you also studied at university and that you actually published several scientific articles. And I was wondering, would you like to tell us a little bit about what you studied and the work you did there as well?
Yes, I was... I have a master's degree in natural resources engineering, and this is an area that at the time that I was studying, I really enjoyed it. So I started to work as a researcher as well. So I was a member of Young Researchers Club, which is a quite high prestige club in Iran, because you have to be top score to be able to be member there. So then as a member of that club, I tried to do some scientific work. So I published some articles in ISI journals. And then I applied to study in Germany. And I got admission from a university. But at the same time, I was offered to work in the Federation and to be General Secretary of Iranian Chess Federation. So I had to choose between continuing there or to be General Secretary of the Federation. I decided to continue with chess, and it was quite tempting at the time because I was the first female General Secretary in all sports. So that's how I didn't continue that area more. But yeah, it's always something that's possible to go back there again.
Yeah, see, I'm a bit biased because I'm German and I'm like a scientist. So I was quite curious. But I have to say, I also read actually about this role you took as a General Secretary of the Iranian Chess Federation. And I thought it was so impressive that not just within chess, but within any sport, you were the first woman to have this role. And yeah, what did you do in this position exactly? And how did you manage to have this massive achievement of being appointed in this position?
I think basically, when you love the things that you are doing, you do your best. And I was always doing my best as an arbiter. I was trying to learn every new things, and I was always studying. And I was writing articles in Iranian websites. I translated rules and regulations. And then at the time, in the whole country, there was only one person who could run live boards, electronic live boards. So then I started to practice everything myself and learn how to work with the digital live words. And when I learned that, that provided me lots of opportunities because I was getting invitation to every tournaments in the country when they wanted to have these live games, right? Then it made me quite famous in chess. And because my English was good in comparison with other Iranians, also it provided me more opportunities. And I think these were the reasons. So I was basically player, organizer, running digital boards with a good English. So that was it.
Just an all-around talent, nothing else to add. No, very impressive. I mean, I don't even know what to say. You know, most people like try to excel in one thing and then there's just you doing well in all aspects. So yeah, pretty cool. Okay. I think we're nearly at the end of our podcast. Some more questions about women's chess in general. So the podcast is part of the FIDE Year of Women in Chess, which is slowly going to an end. But I just wanted your input on what other events, ideas you see that FIDE could do to support women in chess more, whether it's players, arbiters, coaches.
I think what FIDE needs to do is to have long-term plans as well as short-term plans for supporting women's chess. It shouldn't be just advertising for 1 year to make it the year of women in chess, although it's important to have it. But we can ask ourselves what long-term plans we did for female arbiters, what benefits we had from, let's say, Olympiad, what did we do there for ladies, because that was a big tournament that we had chess players from around the world. What was the difference of this Olympiad with previous one? How we made more active female players? Did we increase the number of arbiters or coaches or players? These things should be, planned in advance and then publicized and it's a big work, you know, all the federations, all the continental federations and FIDE needs to work together to make it possible. And I think still we are living in a male-dominated sport. They're not easy for female to continue. We can attract some female arbiters, for example, by participating in a free seminar. But then there's no follow-up for that. What are we going to do them after that? Most of the people who participate in these courses, then they get disappeared. That's why I think that we need to record the numbers. We need to have a follow-up plans and, constant encouragement for females to participate in tournaments and to act in different aspects of chess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some good ideas there. One very final question to end on a bit more personal note. What are your wishes for yourself for the next few months or years? Where do you see yourself? And maybe also, what are your wishes for Iran and the women there at the moment?
Right now, I have all my concentration on Iran, to be fair, because the situation in Iran is in a way that I can't stop thinking about it. I can't really do more concentration on my personal plans because everything is in close tie with the situation of the country. It's not easy to see how many people from your country are being harassed. You see that people are being killed every day. You see that their access to internet massively restricted, and then people think that the regime is not representing people. So these are my main focuses. I want to be voice of Iranian people right now.
Okay, thank you so much, Shari, for being our guest today and for sharing your personal story, which is absolutely fascinating. And to see you excel so much, as I said, as a player, as an arbiter, and also as an ambassador for women's rights. So yeah, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much.